You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, if you haven't heard yet, this is me telling you, you need to take a look at the new boots from Lacrosse, and they fall under the Navigator series. Now, what they've done is they've taken the best parts of a rubber boot and the best parts of your traditional hiking and hunting boot, and they've mashed them together to come up with this new line of boots from Lacrosse, and that is the Navigator series. Now, they have the women's Windrose, they have the men's Windrose, and then they have the Atlas series within that as well. So go to lacrossefootwear.com and check out this new line of boots that they have. I've been using mine for a couple weeks now, and I am very impressed with the fit and the feel, and I can't wait to get them in the woods this hunting season and give them a trial run. So lacrossefootwear.com, check them out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. This is your host, Adam Keith. We're co-owners of a consulting company called, go figure, Land and Legacy. This is your number one podcast resource for all things land.
Each week, we're breaking down topics from land management, habitat management, conservation, farming practices, and real estate. We hope you guys enjoy it. All right, guys, welcome to another Land and Legacy podcast. This is your host, Matt Dye, and I've got special guest Frank Longcarriage, Land and Legacy consultant, here with me as well. We are traveling back down the road from, Frank, your first consultation with us here.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, yeah, kind of southeast Oklahoma, a place I've never really been.
Yeah.
Cool country. Absolutely excited to go with you, and it was a great time.
Man, I always love Oklahoma. I think everyone's probably heard us talk about, you know, the joys of coming to this landscape and this state and just seeing what it has to offer. And it's always a little bit of like that kind of Easter basket feeling, or Easter egg. You never know exactly what you're going to get, because it's a landscape that can change drastically and very quickly. And it's pretty dang diverse when you look across the entire state from east to west.
Yeah, Oklahoma's super diverse. And as I mentioned, I've never been in that part of Oklahoma. I've been across Oklahoma from east to west, and it's a super diverse state. You know, you've got the very edge of the Ozarks in the northeast portion, all the way to the mid-grass, almost short grass prairie in western Oklahoma. Really cool part, or really cool diverse state. And we were kind of in that, as I talked to you a little bit, kind of in that tug of war between tall grass prairie,
yes,
and savanna woodland matrix, and we were kind of in that zone where you're starting to get out of the tall grass prairie or excuse me out of the cross timbers and into that tall grass prairie, and we were on a great property that had a mix of both.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if you're out there and you're listening, you're like, okay, your guys are throwing a bunch of just random terms at me, cross timbers, tall grass prairie, whatever. Think of this just awesome transition line, or if you will, I'm going to air quote this, edge habitat, but this incredible ecosystem of varying habitat types, from shrubs to grasses to forbs to tree components, and all of that mixed up in one, that's this area.
Yeah.
Naturally occurring. So it's like, well, dang. That sounds like a good place to have some deer.
Yeah, yeah.
It was some land, right?
It was great. It was great. It was we saw lots of different ecotypes on,
yes,
this one piece of property. And looking at a map, had no idea that these, even the night before when we were visiting with the landowner, you know, we kind of looked at this and said, oh, we know we might see this here, we might see this here. But once we got on the ground and we started seeing these ecosystems kind of unveiled before us, we're like, wow, this is pretty cool on this one piece of ground. It was some of the most diverse piece of property I've ever been on, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and you've been on a lot of acres from Montana out, you know, you guys just doing some podcasts from when you guys were out in Wyoming
and Nebraska. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But you've been to Wisconsin, you know, Montana, all over the Midwest, and
right,
seen tons of different ground. Managed at a lot of different ground in Missouri. Same thing here. Adam and I have been all across the country. And this this property, though, was just extremely diverse in its ecotypes that it had to offer. But the important takeaway from that is we sat, I don't know how long we were sitting there with the landowner last night before actually getting their, you know, boots on the ground approach, but looking at an aerial photo mm-hmm. and having both very comfortable knowing this cross timbers, tall grass prairie region where there's savannas, woodlands, whatever. We kind of knew the components that we would likely see or we could encounter. But when we're looking over the aerial, again, it did not necessarily reveal that to me in the aerial image. So you can look and study images and aerial maps from, you know, daylight to dark, and that's awesome, and get to know and be familiar with, let's say, just the footprint of a property. But you don't know the impact of that footprint until you're on that property. And I think that's super important from those folks who are out there, you know, whether they're long distance scouting, you yep. know, for a non resident hunt, or, you know, somewhere out of state they're going to go travel to. Aerial photos, again, reveal a lot, but they do not paint the full picture. So getting recommendations, just aerial photos, like, that's tough. Like, yeah. it's very, it can almost, it's kind of deceiving, because if we had tried to make recommendations to the landowner about what needed to happen to reach his goals last night before being on the property, we would have said some of the wrong stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Aerial photos don't tell you species composition.
That's
they
right.
They don't tell yeah. you how these species are arranged on the landscape and how they may interact on the landscape and the disturbance that was historically on the landscape or the disturbance that is currently on the landscape. You really have to get out on the ground to be able to see that. And today, the cool thing about it is in this landscape. So normally when I'm on a piece of property, you're on a tall grass prairie or you're in a woodland. Rarely have I been in a place that had all of those plus the associated glade savanna potential within it. So we were in a particular spot where we were on potential ecosystem change from the bottom of a hill up to the top. And we got to see all of that on one piece of property. And
yes.
looking at the guys from the guy's table the night before, couldn't tell that.
Honestly, all that it looked like from, and we had topo lines, we had everything, but if someone, untrained eye and everything, was looking at that, it would have been, oh, that's just a hardwood ridge.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep. Well, but that's what the aerial showed. That's what yep. it indicated was there. But knowing the historical land use and the true habitat types that are present or should be present in the area, it's like, well, there could be something else there. We could see, you know, potentially some scattered cedar and stuff in that aerial image, but it just did not paint the clear picture as it was on site. And well, even going to some of the areas that had been farmed, you know, mm-hmm. this ground there was probably about 200 acres or so mm-hmm. of Bermuda hay ground.
Right.
And so, but when we got there to some of these areas, he had told us that, let's say he had, again, we're going to air quote this, he had taken some out of production. And that meant they just didn't harvest it for a year.
Yep.
But
didn't
when they didn't,
hay on it.
Yeah, they didn't harvest it for a year, that completely changed the species composition. So maybe it's a lack of disturbance or just the time frame, again, changed the species composition in those stands and redirected our recommendations. But we couldn't tell that from an aerial image that was taken, maybe, I don't even know when it was taken, probably a spring or two ago.
Yeah, it was fairly recent.
Yeah. So, but again, it did not reveal what was there and happening and the influence that it had on the species that he wanted to promote.
Right.
So yeah. That's a huge, huge lesson just right out of the gate.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw some, so when Matt talked about taking it out of production, what happened is we started to see big blue stem show up. We started to see Indian grass show up. We started to see some tick seed sunflowers, some really cool stuff, some split beard, blue stem. Not that it wasn't always there. It was just harvested. It was just cut off all the time, and you couldn't really see it vegetatively until it really sent up a stalk and put its seed head on. And so that gave you then and me a better idea of how to shift it, or what this community could be with a little bit of proper disturbance or different disturbance.
Yeah, and I think that right now is a great time to kind of talk about a discussion that we had with the landowner in the field there. And that is the significance or false understanding of the role that native grasses play in a property managed for the promotion of, let's say, wild turkeys, white-tailed deer, quail, bobwhite quail.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I don't know, I don't want, you know, I'm not going to point a finger or, you know, blame anything, but there's been a lot of publications, a lot of government programs, stuff like that, that's just been a large promotion of grasses, just a grass-dominated stands. And I think in the farmland that a lot of this has been promoted in, because there is just an overwhelming lack of cover, there's been like this native grass put on a pedestal of quality, sound habitat management and recommendations. But as we talked in the field today and looking at, okay, what's coming back in these areas, or, you know, after not being mowed, what some of these native grasses are that are present are, we had the discussion with the landowner of, man, these are great. This is awesome to see as an indication, but we'd also like to see a lot more forbs. So, Frank, talk for a second a little bit, you know, from the quail, from a wild turkey poult situation, the importance of the forbs and the role that they play from just a brood rearing standpoint, and why the composition of forbs versus grasses in a stand, what that ideally looks like.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right about the promotion of native warm season grasses as being this cure-all or this panacea to our wildlife troubles. And to a certain extent, that has helped. CRP has certainly helped.
Sure.
The pheasant population. It certainly helped the duck factory in the upper Midwest, in the Prairie Pothole region. CRP has been a big boon. But that said, it could have been a ton better if the CRP would have been far fewer grasses and more forbs. Just think of the response then pheasants. Think of the response in the prairie grouse species and the quail.
And real quick, I don't mean to cut you off
there. Problem.
But what the difference is between, it's not just like, okay, grasses and forbs. Okay, I get it, guys. But what that means, it's truly the lack of food present on the landscape versus just an overabundance of cover. Whereas forbs can do both.
Right. That's exactly right. So the grass provides the nesting substrate and to some extent the cover and thermal protection for these species. It doesn't provide food resources for these game bird species or turkeys that we're most interested in. Those food resources are coming directly from the forbs in a few different ways. One is the green shoots that they provide. The green leaves is an excellent food resource. Two is the seeds that these forbs produce. Tons of seeds. Grass seed is really not useful for game birds. So these forbs are our seed producers. And probably the most important aspect is the insects.
Yeah.
Forbs are insect factories. These forb-rich communities are full of insects. And the game birds, from bobwhite quail, pheasants, to wild turkey, to prairie chicken, you name it, most of the summer are feeding on insects, and certainly for the first month of their life are almost totally dependent on insects for that high-protein shot in the arm that they need to grow. So
we're getting ready to go through a toll real quick. So if there's a little bit of a weird pause and like, oh, hey, here's $5, I'm just going through a toll in Oklahoma.
Yeah, yeah. So going through a toll, but I will.
Yeah, you run it.
Yeah, so I'll, as we talked about those forbs and those grasses, you absolutely need those grasses for the nesting substrate and for a cover, but the forbs are more important. So Dale
Thanks,
Rollins
sir.
Out of Texas, he talks about the ideal sort of structure of grasses. And he talks about a clump, a basketball-sized clump of native grasses being kind of the right nesting substrate. You need 30 of those per acre. That's pretty sparse, right?
That's really sparse.
That's really sparse. And if
70
you look
yards at, by 70 yards,
yeah,
roughly
so,
an acre.
Right. So if you think about that, so what needs then is going to fill in that? Well, that's going to be Forbes, or that's going to be bare ground. That's going to be these umbrella plants. These rich broadleaf plants are far more important to quail than the grasses are. And then the shrubs are also equally important to quail. But so getting back to your point, I think we've spent a lot of time in the conservation world promoting native grasses. And that's excellent because they have been depleted across the landscape.
It's got us to this point.
It's important. Yes, it's important to get them back on. It's more important to have a native grass landscape for grazing animals rather than a tall fescue landscape. But the Forbs are really where it's at, not only for the little game birds that I manage, but all the way up to the white-tailed deer on this gentleman's farm.
If anyone has questions about it, just revert back to the Old Field podcast about 4 or 5 weeks ago. I did it with Todd Watts, and the production that he's getting out of his Old Field stands, Forbs, in Ohio. This isn't just Oklahoma. This just isn't tall grass, Midwest, prairie states. Forbs are present across the entire North America, where whitetails live, where turkeys live. I don't care what subspecies you're chasing. Forbs are important and need to be promoted in the landscape because of the value from a forage and cover standpoint that they can provide.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have gone in the plantings that I recommend. So let's think in a 15 years of evolution, the plantings that I plant on the properties that I manage, or when I write a management plans for landowners, when I was first really getting rolling with this probably 15 years ago, I was recommending 5 to 7 pounds of native grass seed per acre, plus an associated forb mix, and get it planted and get it rolling. Over time, we have drastically reduced that to now I'm only doing about 1 pound of little blue stem per acre. The rest of my mix is going to be forbs, because that grass, while it's important for a huge natural history component of those birds' lives, it's only a small fraction of it.
Yeah.
They need forbs. They need the associated protein that comes with the insects.
It would be like an equivalent, let's just say, in the deer world of this mindset that deer need and have to have a prolific amount of white oak acorns present in their diet or on their landscape to persist.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's absolutely false. They use it because it is a valuable resource, but it's for such a short amount of time that it's actually productive and produces quality and a quantity of forage that's impactful to their actual diet throughout an entire year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small portion and of high value and importance, but we don't need to oversell the importance, and we need to realize, you know, from an overall standpoint of the role that it does play and keep it in that place, let's say, and not overdo it, because if we're overdoing it, then we're lacking elsewhere in the department of making that ground, that land, as productive as possible for the enhancement of whatever wildlife species you're promoting.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. So you asked a question earlier, sort of what is that ratio?
Yeah.
I'm going to put on my game bird hat here, specifically, you know, Bob White. If I'm going to think about that, I would err, you know, maybe 20 to 30% grasses, and then I want forbs, a matrix of forbs, bare ground, and then woody shrubs to be a large component of that. Shrubs up to 5 to 15% of the landscape of the acreage that I'm managing, and so I'm talking about Bob White quail standpoint. If you're talking about pheasants, mm-hmm. you less shrubs, but so that's just kind of illustrates this sort of the ratio that I would look at to be prime Bob White quail production.
Sure, and what I hope everyone heard right there in that was okay. 20 to 30% grasses, lots of forbs, but then there was the presence of shrubs and woody browse, and that all those components right there make up one, a quality old field stand.
Sure.
But two, that's a very similar composition, maybe a little bit more heavy on the woody browse, the bare ground aspect isn't nearly as important for a white-tailed deer standpoint. However, it's necessary and important to rearing really young poults and bringing in insects and for them to navigate and everything. But if you think about it, if you're in that, let's just say, ballpark, and again, this isn't like the whole food plot thing is, oh, you need 10% of your property in food plots. This 20%, 20 to 30, that's a really good ballpark to find yourself in. Mm-hmm. But if you waver up to 35, 40%, not a big deal if the rest of the other species are present. But if you're dominated by grasses and you're, you know, 70% to 80% grasses and a very minor percentage in forbs, now we're talking that's significant across, let's say, 20 acres of old field. We can change that and alternate that back into the appropriate composition of species there and drastically increase, again, its productiveness. But if you find yourself in that ballpark of what Frank just said in your old field stands, you're probably doing really good for mm-hmm. white-tailed deer. You're probably doing really good for poults and turkeys, brood-rearing poults, and same thing for quail.
Yeah,
there are definite different components, and spatially, let's say they're a little bit different because quail can't travel the distances that deer can.
Right.
However, let's first at least get the components of what's necessary on the landscape. That's job number one. That's phase one. We can fine tune everything else once it's there and present. But right here, like the pastures that we're talking about, are dominated still, even though they weren't cut for hay this year. They just let go. They're still dominated in Bermuda grass, which is an awful attempt of quail habitat.
Yeah.
You know, they can't navigate through that. A young turkey can't navigate through that.
Right. And this gentleman was one of his goals, he stated he would like to have a couple of coveys of quail on his property just to be able to see them and hear them, because everybody loves quail. Nobody's mad at quail. Just being able to hear a Bob White is something a lot of people enjoy on a June afternoon.
Sure.
But he was very, very interested in his turkey population.
Oh, no doubt.
And he was super excited that some of the things that Adam and I, or excuse me, that Matt and I recommended, particularly Matt, for deer, were going to benefit his turkey population. He really liked that aspect. But one of the killers on his property was that Bermuda.
Yes.
So even though turkeys have significantly longer legs than quail, they can no more navigate that Bermuda at hatching time than a quail can.
Yeah.
So, and he even mentioned that. He saw a brood of turkeys the night before, and he noted that they were traveling on his field road, probably because that's the only place they could, he said they
navigate
were bowling ball size, I guess, so they were still fairly small. It's the only place they could really navigate. So
when you think about it, and if you're not familiar with Bermuda grass, if you're from northern states, one, just Google it, check it out. But it's a very turf-forming grass, but it's a warm-season grass, unlike fescue and smooth brome that you may be familiar with. But it's a very wiry grass, and so it grows up among each other, and it's very, very thick from absolute ground level to about a foot tall. It's super thick.
And it's even hard to walk through it. A human to walk through it this time of year when it's laid over.
You
pick your feet up.
You
find yourself avoiding, trying to walk in the field road rather than the Bermuda grass. And so you think about a turkey is the same way.
Yeah.
And so he has some, even though quail weren't his top priority, getting rid of that Bermuda would go a long way to helping his turkey population out, which he was supremely keen on.
Oh yeah. And so I think that, you know, as we often talk about, you know, there's multiple interests or owners, let's say, on this property. And so, you know, he found himself in a balancing act of, okay, production and income off of some Bermuda, but then also looking at the key areas and the areas of importance for wildlife and saying, okay, I know that I have Bermuda here, but what do I do now? Like, how do I take it to the next level? Like, what are the steps I need to take to, again, achieve the goals in these areas and in these boundaries that I've kind of you know, been able to or afford to take out of production and hay. And so we talked a lot about that today, and there's several areas across the whole farm that there is definitely a strong Bermuda presence there. And we even saw potentially this bahia grass in mm-hmm. some areas as well, mm-hmm. other warm season forages. But, you know, we're going to address those in the plan. And from what we saw in the seed bank, yes, there will be native grasses that come back, but many beneficial forb species as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was in a really kind of a – his setup was large enough and was set up spatially such that he could meet some of the needs for production and have production Bermuda grass, but still – have majority of his farm to deer habitat, to turkey habitat. So you can kind of meet both of those.
And that was kind of honestly a little bit of an awakening, if you will, for me. You hear Adam and I talk about, you know, every week, oh gosh, you know, wildlife, wildlife, wildlife. But literally we grew up on farms that we had to balance this stuff out. Mm-hmm. And going into this property today and looking at the map with him, you know, he'd rather himself, you know, his interests, have it all wildlife, but he had to balance it with his the other owner and everything. So, you know, he agreed and you know, talked with that other owner previously. He's like, okay, here's what we can work within. But in my head, like last night and as we're beginning today throughout the property of seeing the elements there, I was like, it's a big, you know, 150 acre section that there's just pretty much just Bermuda. I was like, dang, I don't like that large of an area of just this emptiness and mm-hmm. desert land for wildlife. However, by the end of the day, as we did a tour and the way we parked and stopped, we kind of overlooked a lot of what we had covered. And as we then referencing back on our maps of the notes that Frank and I had taken throughout the day and talked with the landowner, it was like, you know, I'm not nearly as angry at that field now that yeah. we have created some corridors and the vast amount of other areas that we have to be able to devote to wildlife and knowing what's going to come back in those areas because we're seeing these indicator species and these cool plants and the seed bed that's there struggling to get up through the Bermuda and all these other components of the property. We saw that, and I was like, you know what? I'm okay with giving that up and realizing that, you know, that balance of landowners is super important. And I don't think that it's really going to inhibit what the goals you're trying to achieve are based on this plan that we're looking at right now.
Yeah.
It was cool for me to sit back and be like, you know what? I kind of went into this like, man, I'd really like to change that. I'd really like to break that thing up.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of hit me at the end of it. It's like, you know what? I don't think that's all the way necessary.
Yeah. No.
Would it improve it? Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah. But
it, again, it's a balance. And I think that's super important from a plan, a management plan going into it, is knowing and having clear set goals and understanding the land use of that property.
Right.
From a landowner standpoint.
And that's important, too, The gentleman was very honest with us up front when we were sitting at the kitchen table the night before. He said, look, I've got some competing interests that we're going to have to kind of deal with and, mm-hmm. and mitigate or compromise. And so knowing that beforehand helped you certainly, I know it helped me to better understand how to frame the visit the next day to know, okay, you know, we've got some other competing interests. Let's hit what we can really focus on, and it turned out great. It was a very good day, and I think the gentleman left with a clearer understanding of just the special communities he had on his farm that he really didn't know he had.
Well, when we were kind of packing up and getting ready for. You know, say goodbye and whatever, just kind of, you know, this is the next steps. That's what he said. He's like, you know, I'm overwhelmed at, you know, the amount of knowledge, one that you guys were able to share about the property, but there were things about the property that I had no idea even existed and that were even present or even capable that the property could produce this or was this in the past and can be brought back to this. Hey, God, it was just awesome to think, my gosh, what I'm seeing right now is pale in comparison to the vast history of this landscape and the property that we own right now. Because there's so much potential here.
Yeah.
It's like, there is so much potential.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. So from a deer and turkey standpoint, it has huge potential. If you were just from a natural community, just from a...
If you were a nerd like us.
Yeah, if you were a nerd, and he kept kind of referencing that, like, wow. And we told him that there were actually folks that knew more about plants and they got more into it than us. And he said, there's people nerdier than you? And like, well, yeah, there are.
I'll happily admit that.
But even if you took away the deer and he wasn't interested in deer, just from a community standpoint, that property was super special and had a chance to have a ton of really great features enhanced on it because the components were still there.
Yes.
And they were kind of hanging on in places, but they were still there. And with a little bit of work, a little bit of effort, a little bit of fire, boom, you could see something great. So it has great wildlife potential, but also great community restoration potential.
No doubt. And that's the thing about it is, you know, there's going to be a lot of recommendations in this plan. Like, it's going to be very comprehensive of, you've got all these different components that we're going to need to address differently and drastically. However, when we do that, you are going to have something present in your region, in your neighborhood, in your area, probably in your county, that can't be found anywhere else. Like, this property is going to be so incredibly unique because, one, its foundation, its bones are unique, mm-hmm. but two, the way we're going to look at it and attack it and manage it and restore it, going to be stinking awesome.
Yeah, you know, from my perspective, that was refreshing because, to be honest with you, a lot of land that I manage, that I work on, was some kind of previous ag land.
Yeah.
So it had been cropped, it had been otherwise disturbed. So that community, the natural community that was there previously, is pretty much gone.
Yeah.
It had been cropped for so long that when you take off the cropping and you let it succeed back, it's going to be into something that it wasn't historically. Mm-hmm. And we can work with that, and we can deal with that, and we can do some things. But to have a property that really had not been cropped or had
cultivated,
yes, absolutely. So the dirt hadn't been disturbed. To have a property that hadn't seen that level of disturbance was really refreshing because that if I come in and I do some things like remove some trees and reintroduce prescribed fire, I'm going to get something that's pretty darn cool. And like Matt said, could be a showcase to neighbors to hey, this is what is potentially there, you know. And the cool thing is what would come back would be very showy and very aesthetically pleasing.
Oh, totally.
And people could see the benefit of that, not only from a wildlife standpoint, but this is going to enhance my property from a view shed standpoint.
Yes, totally. So let's talk a little bit about the timber, because the timber was kind of the second-ish big stop there along the property tour this morning when we were getting underway. But again, I feel like we're almost like, we're out on a property looking at the habitat. It's almost like a crime scene of either lack of disturbances and you're trying to put the puzzle pieces back together, but really it's like doing forensics on a woodlot and looking at, okay, what are the elements here? What are the clues here that tell me what to do next?
Yeah.
And a lot of what we found in this portion of Oklahoma, and in a lot of different portions of Oklahoma, but is the large, full crown, canopied post oaks.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of those. And it is
wolfy post
wolf,
oaks.
Yeah,
that we
big
about.
Wolf trees or hangman trees.
Yep.
And it was cool to talk to the landowner about it, because he didn't really have a concept of why those trees had the growth form that they did.
Uh-huh.
And to explain to him, they have this growth form because they grew with no competition. And that makes you think, wow.
Wait a second. There's no competition. What are all these cedars doing? Yeah, what do you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And so you can't deny that those cedars don't belong there because this post oak is growing, showing the growth form of having no cedars uh-huh. at one point. And so that gives you the indicator. So seeing those open crown trees was pretty cool and really was the first indication that we had that we're dealing with something that could potentially be restored.
Yeah, definitely. And you guys are probably like, okay, guys, we get it, restoration, let's talk food plots, let's talk killing deer. But these are the aspects of the property that you have to work with. And these are the communities that are present. So if we don't manage that, these communities, plant communities, and the natural resources that are on the property, we're not going to kill the big deer. We're not going to have these improved hunting locations. So this is the framework in which we have to be able to shape the future of this property and improve the potential of harvesting, you know, great deer, more turkeys, whatever the landowner's goals are. But so a recommendation here, obviously, we didn't have this open woodlot, woodland, savanna type feel anymore. It was definitely encroached by eastern red cedar, a lot of elm trees, American elm trees, winged elm, hackberry, hickory. There was definitely a black oak, blackjack, red oak component mixed mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. And understory trees, we saw basswood, we saw catalpa, we saw some redbud, forb component, there was blackberry, there was greenbrier, there was river oats, mm-hmm. there was bottle brush grass, lots of different just things present there, but a lot of cool things that we had to be able to work with, though, too, that said, wow, we can really make this thing that much more beneficial. But with all that being said, we identified that we had a wood lot that was a mixture of woods and grasses long time ago, woods, grasses, and forbs a long mm-hmm. time ago, but now it's just closed canopy.
Yeah. So there was a lot of those indicator plants. We talk about that. These indicator plants that are specific are restricted to these certain community types. And we saw those indicator plants on the ground. So they were struggling for sunlight, though we saw some native trailing lespedeses that were mm-hmm. certainly struggling for sunlight. But we realized that, hey, this native lespedeza grows only in woodlands or at the transition between a woodland and prairie. So that tells us that that's probably what this community was historically. And probably if we try to restore it, we're going to see a lot more of this.
Get that back.
Yeah. Yeah, because that root system, that root bank is still there. It's still holding on, and it's just ready to go at the first hint of sunlight to shoot up. And there were some pockets, you know, where it may have been a deadfall or whatnot, where we saw some of that. But one of the cool things that I appreciated about you, Matt, is you would quiz the gentleman about different aspects. So when we were standing in this woodlot, you said, so what would you expect a deer to be doing in this particular woodlot? And nothing really more than just passing through. There was certainly no place to hide.
Right.
There was certainly no forage on the ground. It was just a place to pass through. And that's not maximizing your habitat.
No, I don't want to have a landscape or a woodlot or, you know, that portion of the property was probably, let's say, 30-ish acres. I don't want 30 acres of a property just a place where deer are passing through.
Right.
If I've got 30 acres to my name deeded on land, that ought to be productive to some degree, more so than just, hey, deer pass through here.
Absolutely.
And so if I have, especially if I have these resources available, like the post oak, the woodland, transition prairie, like, one of the conversations that we had today in the field, and we talked about it on a podcast. There's a podcast that we did probably a year ago, and it was referring to the value of the sunlight. And it goes back to if you have a property that has maximum ability to capture sunlight, which is strictly an energy resource for living creatures, plants, and animals. If you can harness more of that on the ground level, you're going to have a more productive landscape for the critters you're trying to promote, like the white-tailed deer, the wild turkey, things like that. Yes, squirrels need trees, I get all that. But we're talking about white-tailed deer and turkeys. And the more sunlight, though, that you have getting to the ground, the more productive it's going to be. So when we have these woodlots that are completely shut off from the sunlight, we might have tops throughout a day, 5% of the canopy letting sunlight in.
Yeah.
Well, that's like 95% bad,
yeah,
roughly, and 5% good. And it's like, we need more good than bad, so I need to manage this and change the way it looks. And so I don't want 30 acres of just deer pass through here. I want, you know, 30 acres of awesome quality habitat that deer will be able to utilize. And, you know, we've thrown out, again, on other podcasts, the value of closed canopy forests and what they bring from a forage aspect are so incredibly unproductive, mm-hmm, for deer on an annual basis, that if you just change that and you manipulate that, your productivity across those acres, if turned into, let's say, grasses and forbs underneath of canopy trees that produce mast, now we're looking at like 1,000 pounds plus forage per acre comparative to 50 to 100 in closed canopy forests. It's like, that's nuts.
Yeah.
You put prescribed fire through that system,
mm-hmm,
it's only increasing. And it's like, holy cow, we're talking like the difference between feeding, that would be like one deer, because,
mm-hmm,
they eat about 2,000 pounds of food a year. So that 20 to 30 acres would produce roughly that, to now producing enough forage every 2 acres to carry a deer. And it's like, that's the value of going through and doing this and addressing these woodlots that you're like, oh, just deer pass through it. Well, no. That's valuable real estate that we can use to get there to that goal. We just need to know overall and associate numbers to its productiveness and its, or let me say, its lack of productiveness and where it could be by doing these techniques. It's like if you had a business that was, or a portion of a business that was underperforming every single year by 95% comparatively speaking to the rest of the business, what would you do with that?
Yeah.
Would you fire it? Would you change it? Well, yeah, you would,
yeah,
do one of the two.
Yeah.
It's either, well, you can't sell it because that wouldn't make sense.
Right.
You just manipulate because it's a property that you own and you improve it. So you bring it up from, let's say, a value of 5% compared to 100% productiveness. You bring it up from a 5% through the years, you get it on up to 100% or whatever. It's going to take time, but don't just neglect those acres.
No, absolutely not. We talk about usable space in the game bird world, but it applies to the wild turkey world. It applies to the white-tailed deer world. If a space is not usable, why would an animal be there? So it's important to maximize the amount of usable space you have. And in a situation like this, where it was this closed canopy woodland, or closed canopy, it's forest now, but it had been close, probably woodland, you know, a little bit of tree work, cutting some trees, just cutting and dropping them,
mm-hmm,
or certain trees, girdling and maybe treating them.
Yep.
Whatever the prescription may be, it's relatively not difficult to all of a sudden take something that's unusable and that's closed canopy to making it usable again. It's a little bit of work, it's sweat, you may have to hire a contractor if you choose to go that route, you may have to put some fire breaks in, but overall it's not a huge transformative process that takes a lot of time and money. You can attack an acre and really make a difference.
Totally. Visually, you know, when you go in and you're dropping these 20-foot tall cedars underneath these canopies, yeah, it's going to look different. But truthfully, to do that for an acre in this density that was occurring, it's not that much work.
No.
I mean, you think about it. You're proficient with a chainsaw. I'm proficient with a chainsaw. You know, we can go in a morning situation and do easy, between the two of us, probably 5 acres.
Yep.
Go home, take a nap, come back, do it in the afternoon. We cover 10 acres that day.
Yep.
10 acres. Yeah, it's do okay, let's just say you devote 3 weekends a year, you and your buddy who own a property, you do this kind of stuff. You just covered 30 acres in a year.
Yep.
If you own 120 acres, which is a decent-sized place, right? Average-sized place. You just covered 25% of that prop. No, that's not right. You covered, what, 18% or something like that of that property. Is that right? Gosh, I'm driving.
I'm not good with math. So
I said 120 acres and you did 30 acres?
30, so that's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's 25%.
Yeah, 25%. That's a fourth of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. You just covered a fourth of the ground in 1 year.
Yeah, so take some February weekends when there's nothing to shoot.
Yeah.
And it's cold. Get out, put your chaps on, put your safety equipment on, warm yourself up by cutting trees. It's a great way to spend a February weekend. And there's nothing to shoot anyway. Get your habitat in order.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect time, as we talked about also, to put some of those bud-producing trees on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
At the time deer need the most, too. So you can kind of strategize it to not only manipulate your habitat, but also put food on the ground for the deer when they need it the most.
If you're a landowner and you complain about cabin fever in February, you need to get out and do something on your property.
Yeah.
Or you have an amazing property and you've already done it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
there's
no excuses for not being able to have, you know, if you're not already busy on your February weekends, this is the perfect thing to be able to do. And know, again, the value that the property has in those acres right now. But no, that's the accomplishment, though, is knowing what you're shooting for.
Yep.
And if you don't have a management plan or an understanding of the value that these acres bring to your goal, then it seems insignificant. It seems like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm dilly-dallying, I'm cutting some trees down. But no, you're creating more food. You're creating more cover. You're allowing more sunlight in. You're changing the land use from the wildlife aspect and the productiveness of it for the better.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, but it literally is that simple. And so this gentleman has got a lot of prescribed work in the timber to, yes, restore some of the woodland type plant communities,
mm-hmm.
which is going to bring incredible value. And one of the things I really just appreciate about him was his receptiveness and interest in the, and it sounds so dorky, but the water table,
mm-hmm.
and the infiltration differences that these woodlot acres restored with cut cedars was going to have on the general landscape, not just on his place, but remember, we all live downstream.
Mm-hmm.
This is changing things downstream of his place just as much. He's going to hopefully have some springs recharged.
Yeah.
And by bringing back these deep-rooted plant communities, we're pulling more water into the water table.
Yeah. So he had some springs that were clearly dried up, and
inactive.
They were cedar choked.
Yeah.
He had a wet weather creek that went through there. I shouldn't say wet weather. It had pools of water all year long, but I would imagine that it would probably flow, but the spring certainly would come back.
Yeah.
And that stream would probably flow more perennially.
Mm-hmm.
But just think about increasing the amount of herbaceous cover that was there, or the amount of herbaceous ground cover. Well, then then you're building organic matter over time,
yep.
which then acts as a water sponge.
Yep.
And that's not being built when there's closed canopy forest,
no.
closed canopy hardwood. So you're going to have a much better water holding capacity just by cutting a few trees, letting the sunlight hit the ground, build up that herbaceous ground flora, feeding a lot more deer, feeding a lot more turkeys, increasing your organic matter. It's a wonderful cycle that can be had just by returning the landscape to the way it was intended to be.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And the value of this work is, again, you know, Frank, you're a hunter.
Yep.
I'm a hunter.
Right.
I love this kind of stuff because I know by default, by doing all this work, my gosh, we're improving these acres for wildlife. But again, it just doesn't stop there as in a improvement for just wildlife. We're talking about improving the landscape. We're talking about improving this land and creating or restoring water. Like water and aquifers and springs and seeps on these hillsides, this can't happen. And hopefully when the work is done, it will happen. Hopefully there's pictures of before and after of what it was we saw today.
Yeah.
Let's come back 5 years from now, and it's going to be a different world.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it. We got rain last night. We drove through rain all the way here. Those springs weren't running.
No. His timber, the roads were a little wet, but his timber was pretty dry. So
yeah.
It ran off, and it left his property, which isn't good for if he wanted to build food plots at some point, which he's got in his plan. You know, he wants to have a duck marsh there as part of his long-term plan. Well, if he's losing water because he can't hold the ground, can't hold it, then, you know, that potential project may have a harder time getting off the ground at that point. So there was a lot of benefits to that. And coming to that point, I think, on his property, we noticed we got off the Polaris, and Matt kind of went up a hill by himself, and he called back to me and said, "Hey, I think I see a glade up here." And not only did he see a small glade remnant, but we stumbled into something that was pretty darn cool.
This entire big complex hillside. Yeah, we couldn't see up through the cedars past what was that small little remnant I thought I saw, and started looking. It's like, oh gosh, yeah, this is. We saw a little bluestem. We saw lead plant, not lead plant. We saw Lespediza,
Blazing Star. Yeah.
And then it was like, wait a second, let's just kind of keep going. And we kept going, and then it opened up into this massive potential glade complex. And I was like, holy cow!
Yeah, we were in a spot where it was a sandstone glade, so it was kind of unique. But if you could envision the trees gone, and we were in a little spot that for some reason most of the trees were gone. There was kind of one wolfy blackjack there, but it gave the landowner a really good idea of what this could acres of this could look like, and it was on a south facing slope, so perfect wintertime bedding area because it's got that warmth that it's going to capture. It was probably my favorite spot on the property, even though it wasn't restored, just the potential that it had to have a unique component that is largely lost. Glades in a lot of places are completely gone because of cedar and blackjack or other invasion. We were finding coneflower, little leaflets trying to stick its head up there. We were finding all these cool indicator plants. I was flipping rocks looking for scorpions, you know, just kind of, you know.
I didn't turn over a rock.
Yeah, I don't know. I love scorpions and tarantulas for some reason. But it was a really, really cool feature. And there were some fire scars on the trees.
Oh, yeah.
So you could see how fire had once kept that open. And it was really a good spot to bring the landowner to show. And I think you showed him pictures later of what a glade might look like. So he could kind of get the idea of what this could look like with restoration. It was great. I would love to have a piece of that to restore on my own.
Yes.
How cool that would be.
Yes, no doubt. Because, again, we can see what isn't present there right now and know the value that brings to the overall property. And that's a place, we were talking about it because it went up a steep slope and then it was almost like a tabletop mesa-like.
Yeah.
But it transitioned to a flat top ridge that was more or less likely to it had the woofier post oaks there. So it was more of a savanna-like feel that needed to be restored there. Yeah. But we're sitting there at the crest of this little flat top mesa, And it was like there's a big sandstone rock there and a massive post oak. And it was like, can you imagine the fire that just ripped up this slope and then just dropped and settled back down across this flat top. And what we couldn't do was see through past the cedars and to see the incredible view that this property had to offer.
Right.
And it was just so encroached and so overdone that we're like, oh man, you know, we can't see that. But I guarantee you 5 years from now, if you come and you do this, you're going to be looking over a glade that is in the summertime, pick a month, I don't care, June, July, August.
Yeah.
It's going to be full of color, full of bloom when you restore this. And this is someplace that I would like to go and watch a sunset with my wife or take my kids and tell them what happened. And you know, it's just... That's the value of land, and that it doesn't have to just be a wildlife component that it improves, but it's bringing the family out there and showing these teaching moments and these educational opportunities of, man, this is what Oklahoma has to offer.
Yeah.
This is Hughes County, Oklahoma. Look at this.
Yeah, and the gentleman had two young boys, and he was already talking about the future and how he wanted to bring his boys up hunting on this property and really get them immersed in this landscape. But it was cool. Now that he's got the knowledge to be able to take his family to that place and talk about the historic disturbances, point out some of those indicator plants. He may not remember every name, but he can remember, hey, this is a sun-loving plant.
Yes.
This is growing here for that reason. Look at this cat-faced tree. There was a fire that came up here at one point. And not only that, but bring it back to the wildlife standpoint, we talked about standing there, how in that little micro little glade that the trees were kind of gone from that spot, we could say, look, how much better is a turkey pull off here?
Yes.
Because it's got cover, it's got forbs, compared to 30 feet over here where it's just leaf litter. And he could really put that together and say, wow, you're right. If this extended all the way around this ridge, I've got great brood habitat, right? On a cold February day, south-facing slope, I've got great thermal cover for my deer here, too.
Mm-hmm.
He could really kind of put that together and see the benefits because he already had some of that potential habitat available. That was unique about that is because we had that there, that little micro area, he could see what it could potentially be instead of having to imagine what this would look like.
Trust these two guys came with the property, right?
Yeah. So he had that,
uh-huh.
and that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think overall, you know, as we're talking about all these different components, and I think, you know, we were both excited about many aspects of the property, and one of the ones that I think kind of clicked for him as we're getting kind of closer to your exit here. Don't let me miss this.
I won't.
But as we were talking about the deer hunting and the elements of all these different plant communities that are present on the landscape and how to make them beneficial for hunting and how to access stand locations, we came across one that had just dynamite access, and that, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out that, my gosh, when we do the recommendations that we're talking about in these open fields and restore these old field plant communities, and we're coming in and clearing out the cedar, this area is going to provide thick cover for deer. We've got incredible access with these high bank creeks. We're going to drop down, loop around, come on the downwind side of this with a north wind. We got food plot to the west. We got food plot to the east. We got thick cover that's a sanctuary. We never go in. We never go out until it's the right time. We have perfect access. We come in here, and it's going to happen right here.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, right here, at some point, you're going to have an opportunity to shoot a great deer.
Yeah, and he got super jazzed at that. I mean, I was kind of watching him as you were explaining this. And he was ready to grab his bow at that point. Like, let me find a tree. And that's one of the cool things that Land and Legacy provides, not only this habitat knowledge base, but this also ability to take a piece of property and to show a landowner, this is how we can arrange it to make your hunting better.
Yeah.
We can not only create the habitat, but we can make access points. We can show you access points. We can lay the habitat out where you've got the best chance possible to kill that deer that you want to kill. Just how we lay out. And that's a cool thing that Land and Legacy provides, that going out with you today, I really struck home that not only are you guys providing comprehensive landscape management advice, but on the ground hunt management, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. And that gets me jazzed up too. Cause it's like, you know, I want to envision, if you will, like myself and how I'm going to approach this, you know, this location to hunt, or is it even a location to hunt? Is it one of those ones that, no, we're not coming in here. The deer that are using this because it is good, we're going to hunt them elsewhere because it's just, it's kind of inaccessible. So let's not put pressure here, but let's just kill them in transition elsewhere. You know, that's, I want to address it and approach it from that line of thinking. That's going to be, okay, when I go in and when I hunt, that is when I want to be successful. I don't want to just be bumping around. You know, I like to observe deer, but when I go into something, an area that's you know, let's say kind of ultra sensitive, I want to go in there. I want to be successful. Mm-hmm. And those are the key areas that we definitely can identify based on the management of the resource that's there. And again, when you look at the biology of deer and what they do year in and year out, it's pretty dang simple. November time frame, they do the same thing. They chase does, and does do the same thing. They get out of the way of bucks.
Yeah.
Where they go thick, gnarly, brushy areas of dense cover. And that's what we can promote, and that's what we can create on a landscape and provide that and provide you know, the insight of how deer are going to travel from A to Z. And that A may be a food plot and Z may be a bedding area. We're going to use topography to dictate that. So there's all these different features that really come together throughout spending a day with a new landowner on the property. There's all these different things, components that we try and address and look at and make a plan to achieve the landowner's goals. And I think, I truly do think that after being there and chatting with him about the direction of the property, I mean, I've got high hopes for it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's an awesome opportunity for him to take hold of this plan, see it through. We'll help him through it, the implementation of it, and then just from a hunting aspect, really benefit from it.
Yeah, and I was clear. It was clear in first meeting the gentleman. This was a fairly new piece of property that they required a year and a half ago or so, and to see his excitement, which was evident, he was excited about the property, but to see his excitement at the end of the day today when he knew what he truly had, I mean, that from my perspective, not having any interest in that land other than wanting to see him achieve his goals, his excitement at the end of the day was, wow, this was, I've got better piece of ground than I ever knew I had.
Yes.
And it's all there. I just didn't have the information or the knowledge to know what I had. And he does now. And he has a great roadmap to enhancing the deer that are already there.
Yes. Yes. And so I'm jazzed up about it. I know you are, and I know he is too. So hopefully, guys, this podcast has been kind of a learning situation for you guys to know, like, what we want to achieve when we go to a property and we evaluate it. We want to gain knowledge and share that knowledge of the landscape with the landowner. And I can study a map ahead of time, and I can have a good idea. I can do some research, but until you get there, you know, we're throwing darts at a wall, trying to anticipate exactly the plant communities and the exact recommendations that need to happen to manage the resource appropriately. And so that was a great example. We wanted to share it with you guys on the ride back home. And again, hopefully it just kind of, it makes sense for you guys as to what it is our goals and objectives are when we meet a new landowner, have the ability, the blessing to work with them. And so, you know, hopefully something you learn something through this podcast about, again, whether it's natural resources, whether it's unique ecosystems, or the biology of some game birds or game species. But we appreciate you guys listening. And be sure to follow us on social media, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. Go follow Upland Flush on Instagram. That's Frank and Kyle Hedges. You know, they're a huge wealth of information, guys. So make sure you follow them. And we'll be having some more podcasts here soon, more videos. We're going to be jumping in a tree. I head to Virginia this next week for a couple new consultations. And Adam heads to Mississippi. So we'll have a little bit of a lull in some hunting activity. But we will soon be back at it. Yeah. Frank, you getting at it all?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. My son is jazzed up about deer. He is 14.
They don't stand a chance.
No.
We
put a Stratton seed blend in behind our house about 2 weeks ago. Got some great rain on us. Got some good response. He's jazzed up. Got a new crossbow. This kid is excited.
Talk about darts, man.
Yeah. So
look
my
out.
Yeah. So I'm super excited, more so for him, to get out there and start enjoying that. And thanks so much for bringing me along on this trip.
Man,
I had a great time. I enjoyed it. Learned so much. So appreciate it.
Absolutely. This is the first of many to come, so looking forward to it as well. You guys are going to be hearing, again, a lot more from Kyle and Frank podcasts. You guys have got some other pre-recorded podcasts from your trip out west that we need to drop and unload. And so y'all just be listening and continue to follow along, guys. Appreciate it. And if you have any questions, feel free to email us at info@landandlegacy.tv. And we'll get with you. Appreciate you guys listening. We'll see you next week. Yeah.